Well, thank you, Annalise, for opening today's service. And greetings to all of you from my home study across the Puget Sound in Port Townsend. I'm so pleased to be with you again this morning as we come near Christmas, because as a minister, Christmas is my favorite time of the year in terms of planning and implementing services. And I'm going to give a fairly lengthy introduction to my first of two readings this morning. It's really part of my message for this Sunday that's prior to the winter solstice and prior to Christmas Eve. So fair warning on that. But this past week, I had the opportunity to read a print version of the sermon that your speaker from last week, Joseph Benaric, delivered. And those of you who were tuned into that service may recall Joseph's account of playing Ebenezer Scrooge in what he said was, quote, a very amateur theatrical reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which he said took place at a Christmas party a number of years ago that he attended. Well, as it happens, that Christmas party was held in my house here in Port Townsend, where each year my wife Flossie and I would invite the staff members, of which he was one, from our fellowship, the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We'd invite them to a Christmas party, and it always included the reading of a condensed version of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And yes, my wife and I do recall the year in which Joseph did take on, with great delight, that role of Ebenezer Scrooge. Even more, however, we recall the year that he, this big-boned, six-foot-plus frame and deep, resonant voice, took on the role of Tiny Tim. And I have to laugh just recalling that. Well, Joseph, as I said, was on our staff. He was my assistant in the pulpit. He's a lay person, but I noticed this talent he had. And so I was able to get him as an assistant in the pulpit. 8 years he served as my assistant, 2011 to 2018. And we combined messages on more than one occasion at this time of the year, trying to get at what one year we titled The Heart of Christmas. And then one Christmas Eve, the title of our messages was The Unassailable Core of Christmas, a title which I suspect may be unique in the history of Christmas Eve services, and which yesterday I somewhat confirmed by Googling it. And indeed, the only entry that came up for the words The Unassailable Core of Christmas was from our local newspaper, The Leader, December 22, 2015, where it advertised Bruce Bode and Joseph Benaric each give Christmas meditations on the unassailable core of Christmas. Well, a part of that unassailable core of Christmas, as Joseph related last Sunday, has to do with the possibility of a frozen heart like that of an Ebenezer Scrooge being broken wide open. Ebenezer Scrooge, of course, is the very embodiment of a person whose heart has been closed off and shut down by the disappointments and difficulties of his life, so that he has become a hard, pinched, self-protective, miserly, stingy, shriveled, uncharitable, joyless figure who casts a pall over everything he touches. And yet, the dream, the possibility of the Christmas spirit still lives within him. Ebenezer Scrooge is still redeemable, which we discover when his heart is blasted wide open on Christmas Eve by the triple visitation of the ghosts of Christmas, past, present, and future. And then when Ebenezer Scrooge awakes from that dream, he knows exactly how to celebrate Christmas. He knows how to show the generosity of a heart that had been pinched for too long. Well, that was part of what Joseph spoke about last Sunday. And this Sunday, I'm also going to speak with you about what I regard as another part of that unassailable core of Christmas. Last year, I also was given the opportunity to lead this service that is closest to Christmas. And though it's unlikely that you've forgotten, I will remind you that the sermon title at that time was, What Child Is This? And it was a sermon that explored the question of at what level do you take this holy birth in Bethlehem? And the approach that I shared with you at that time, it's the approach that I've taken throughout my ministerial career and the approach I will take again this morning, is what I call re-mythologizing the stories of Christmas. And not simply demythologizing them, which has to do with uncovering what is factual and historical in them, but re-mythologizing the stories. That is, not worrying so much about the historical and factual in the stories, but taking the stories as stories and what they might mean for us personally, inwardly, psychologically, and spiritually. And the core story of Christmas, as I take it, is the recognition of a creative and generous potential in every life. And that's symbolized in the birth of a divine child, which may occur at any time and any place. And this finally brings me then to our first reading this morning, which is the Christmas story that probably more than any other has captured the human imagination. It's the story of the birth of the Christ child from the Gospel of Luke. And so I invite you now to let go of historical and literal elements and to take this story inwardly, mythologically, spiritually. And what that means is that everything in the story applies to you. It's your story. And so that you are the mother, Mary, who is overcome at the birth of her firstborn child and pondering the meaning of this birth. And you are Joseph, attentive to your partner and no doubt amazed at the miracle of birth that has occurred. And you are the angels. You're the bearer of good tidings, joyously spreading the good news of this birth to all who will hear. And you are the shepherds, initially frightened by such news, but open to it, curious about it, and drawn to explore for yourselves what this birth might be about. And finally, you are yourself the Holy Child, and it is the birth of your own spiritual life and its potential that is being witnessed and celebrated. So listen now, again, to the Christmas story from the Gospel of Luke. I'll read the first 20 verses of the second chapter. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. This taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, everyone into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. But the angel said unto them, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger." And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward all." And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, "Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us." And they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept these things and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, even as it was told unto them. The birth story from the Gospel of Luke. Now, in keeping with this account of the birth of the Holy Child of Bethlehem, our first song is titled Still, Still, Still. It's a Christmas lullaby originating in Salzburg, Austria, describes the peace of the infant child and mother as the baby is sung to sleep. It's performed by the virtual choir of the First Congregational Church in Bellevue, Washington, which is accompanied by the Rainier Symphony. In addition to the traditional reading of the Christmas story from the Gospel of Luke, I also have a contemporary reading this Sunday before Christmas, and it's a short poem by Jacob Trapp, which speaks about silencing, if only for a Christmas Eve night, the pragmatic, critical, cynical parts of our minds. And George, could you bring up that poem for us? I, who have knelt before no gods this year, have sudden need to kneel me in the snow. When round me, like the rush of wings, I hear the midnight chimes and carolings, I know I am not meant to live on cynic's dole, to speak the mocking word and wear disdain as one who wears behind a mask a soul as parched for beauty as a drought for rain. I, who have lived insensible of loss, now kneel in wonderment of light that fills a waiting world from Bethlehem, the cross and gentleness that walked forgotten hills. How long ago? Ah me, how dull we are, how slow of heart, how blinded by a star. Our second Christmas song is titled Journey of the Angels. Angels who, learning of the birth of a newborn king, begin their flight to assist the Holy Child. Somewhere in a winter night, the angels begin their flight. They fly to you, O newborn king. One is sorrow, one is peace. One will come to give you sleep. One is comfort, one is grief. One will take the tears you weep. This lovely meditative piece is composed and sung by the contemporary musical artist Anya. Well, I begin my sermon message this Sunday before Christmas with a long, involved, complicated sentence from scholar of world religion, Joseph Campbell. And in the introduction to his last major work on mythology, it was called An Atlas of World Mythology, Campbell, who was then in his early 80s, wrote these words, which I've asked George to put on a slide so that they could be more easily digested. Thanks, George. Campbell writes, this is all one sentence now, the first function of a mythology is to waken and maintain in the individual a sense of wonder and participation in the mystery of this finally inscrutable universe, whether understood in Michelangelo's way as an effect of the will of an anthropomorphic creator, or in the way of our modern physical scientists and of many of the leading Oriental religious and philosophical systems, as the continuously created dynamic display of an absolutely transcendent yet universally immanent mysterium tremendum et fascinans, that is, a mystery both frightening and fascinating, which is the ground at once of the whole spectacle and of one's self. Thank you, George. I hope you got all of that. Of this service. Now, what Campbell is saying is that the first role, the first function of mythology and religion, and it's not necessarily the first function in terms of one's personal development, but the first function in importance is to wake you up to the wonder of your life and of all life, to shake you and to rouse you from slumber so that you come alive to the absolute miracle of your being and of all being, of any being. Does it matter how you come to this sense of wonder and participation in your world? In one sense, I'm a complete pragmatist when it comes to religion, which is to say, I'm not so much interested in how you were awakened, but that you are awake. I don't care so much about the method as the results. And indeed, what awakens one person to wonder is not necessarily what awakens another person. But the question is, are you awake? Are you awake to the miracle of your existence, to the miracle of all existence? To my mind, this is what the Christmas season is ultimately about, with Christmas Eve being the pinnacle of the season, pointing as it does where the star has stopped, pointing to the miracle and holiness of life here and now. How do we point to and express the miraculousness of our lives? Well, it seems we need stories, images, metaphors, and symbols. It seems we need to hear and see something outside of ourselves in order to stir the energies within ourselves. And thus, for those young in years, Santa Claus is born. Santa Claus is an image for children of the wonder and miracle of life. He's an absolutely miraculous figure for young children. Have you ever seriously watched children being brought to the throne of Santa Claus? And I'm not talking here about Santa's helpers. I'm talking about the real Santa. Children are in awe of Santa Claus. He is a figure both fascinating and also a little frightening, a mysterium tremendum et fascinans, a mystery both overwhelming and fascinating. I recall some years ago catching up on the real news of the day with the irreverent Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, and he mentioned that his son, who was 2.5 years old at that time, he mentioned that his son had been completely taken by Santa Claus. Jon Stewart, of Jewish heritage, was apparently lighting Hanukkah candles in his home during the week, but he commented that his child cares little for this ceremony. Instead, he had been captivated and captured by Santa Claus. Well, why not? Why wouldn't a child be captured by this great, good, generous, gift-giving figure who knows and loves the heart of a child? If you've never met another miracle in your life, you've met it here. And you know that the world is capable of being miraculous. Now, later in life, there is a little speed bump for children to negotiate when they discover that Santa Claus is not real in the way that they first thought. And there's a question to be answered. Is the miraculousness and holiness that was felt in Santa Claus' presence, is that real, or is that miraculousness and holiness is an illusion? It's a little bit of a shock to the system to realize that Santa has to be taken at a different level. Usually, however, this speed bump can be quite easily negotiated, and actually it can open up whole new avenues of discovery, whole new avenues and approaches. So most people do find a way to jump that literalistic Santa Claus hurdle. It's a child's first demythologizing opportunity, you might say. Most children, as I say, quite easily find that they're able to take Santa Claus in another way, not a literal incarnation of warmth and goodness, but an image, a symbol of it. They know and feel that Santa is a way of embodying the qualities of generosity and loving kindness. And because of this image, they may also strive to embody more of those qualities in their lives. And thus, as adults, upon seeing Santa, he brings to us a lovely reminiscence. We remember the good saint. We recall the goodness of the world that this embracing warmth of the figure embodies. And it calls us then also to try to embody a bit more of that goodness in our own lives. But if a child moving into adulthood were to insist that Santa Claus is an actual being rather than a mythological being, then that beautiful image is tarnished and becomes an idol. And whereas the image is supposed to open you to the wonder, beauty, and goodness of life and being, it will now hold you back. It will block you from these qualities because you are worried about whether it is physically and actually so. how could Santa and his reindeer literally visit every person in the world in one night, all that stuff. All right. I trust you see where I am going with this. As many young people and adults find they have to face the same kind of questions with regard to the stories of the Christ child, the child of Bethlehem, the babe in the manger. Did God literally descend to earth from heaven and take the form of a human infant in a small town in Palestine some 2,000 years ago? Did a host of angels appear to shepherds on a hillside near Bethlehem? Was there really a specially created star that appeared in the sky to lead wise men to a recently born infant king? These literalistic questions of the Christ child quickly become painful and absurd, so that soon the beauty and meaning first felt in the story dissolves. An elastic image meant to point one to the holiness of life becomes instead a millstone dragging one down. The image becomes an idol, and far from opening one to the miracle and wonder and divinity of life, it ends in a cul-de-sac of cosmological conundrums. So there's a demythologizing speed bump to be negotiated with respect to these stories of the birth of the divine child. Now, in a minute, I'm going to have George play a piece of music that relates to an individual who struggled with this speed bump of literalism. It's a piece of music related to the miracle stories of the religion of this composer's youth. It's not a Christmas song, and I hope it doesn't clash too much with the other Christmas music for this service. But as you will see, it relates to how we can take the miracle of Christmas. So the words and the music you are about to hear are from someone you may know, Peter Mayer. He was formerly a theological student, and he has one of the favorite hymns in our supplemental hymnal, Singing the Journey. It's called Blue Boat Home. And the song we will now hear is titled Holy Now. So please attend to the words of the song. They'll appear on the screen, because they relate to moving beyond miracle stories as literal events of past history to metaphorical stories meant to point one to the miracle of life here and now. I can't tell from this song whether Peter Mayer, who is the writer and composer, appreciated his religious heritage and saw it perhaps as a necessary stage in his faith development, or whether he felt that his heritage had blocked him from the revelation that everything is holy now. Did he feel he had to break with his heritage in order to discover the truth of the holiness of life? I don't know, but whatever the case, he has broken through and he has discovered what Joseph Campbell referred to as the first function of religion. He has been awakened to wonder and to the miracle of life and being. And some of the words that I particularly like from this song are, wine from water is not too small. Now that refers to the first miracle story of Jesus in the Gospel of John, where it says that Jesus turned water into wine at a wedding ceremony. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one. In other words, what we call miracles, whatever we call miracles, are only secondary miracles and wonders. The primary miracle, the primary wonder, is that anything is here at all. For when you have been awakened to the fact that nothing had to be, that there might have been nothing rather than something, then everything that has being is a miracle. Everything, as poet E.E. Cummings says, has been lifted from the no of all nothing. And this, I would submit, is the real root of this miracle story of this divine birth in Bethlehem, if you can move past its literalism. The story of the birth of the Christ child so long ago is a story, a metaphor, a symbol of the miracle of being here and now. And in three ways, real quickly. First, the story of the birth of the holy, of the divine child becomes the story of the holy birth of every child, and of your own birth as well. It has to do with the divine creative potential in each of us. The unassailable core of Christmas says that the divinity is always there within us, and our task is to awaken and to reawaken to it so that we can bring that potentiality into actuality. And thus, each year at Christmastide, the divine child needs to be born again so that we might also be born again into the divinity, into the holiness and goodness of our own lives. Each year, we need to be recalled to our better selves. And secondly, in the birth of the divine child, there is the recognition of the power of all creation here in this earth. The full power and presence of being has been incarnated here in this earth, in this land, in this community, and in those of you tuning into this service today. This earth and all of its life forms are not, as Pierre Mayer's song puts it, heaven's second-rate hand-me-downs. Rather, they're a full expression of the power of divinity. And then thirdly and finally, the story of the birth of the Holy Child that has come down to us from Lo so many years ago is a recognition of creativity itself, pointing, as Joseph Campbell put it, to that continuously created dynamic display of an absolutely transcendent and yet universally immanent mystery, a mystery both frightening and fascinating, that is, the ground of all things, ourselves included. And it came to pass in those days, not really a story about something that happened long ago, but really truly a story about something that is happening now, that is always happening, a story of present creation, a story of continuous creation. For the creation is going on, and the creation is ongoing. The miracle is always happening, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. As T.S. Eliot puts it, quick now, here now, always. Can you, do you believe that? If neither I nor Pierre Mayer can convince you to attend to the holiness and the miraculous of life and being in this Christmas season, perhaps Josh Grogan can. As we conclude today's service, I want to thank our celebrant, Annalise Vance Sherman, for so ably assisting me in the service, and thank also our behind-the-scenes media technician, George Rogers Clark, for bringing in the readings and music at their appointed times. He has to really be on his toes when these advertisements suddenly spring in there. And again, of course, our program director, Sally Riggers, and particularly in this service for most of the musical selections that you have heard, those were her suggestions. Thank you, Sally, for that. As I said at the beginning of the service, I delight in preparing and delivering these services in the Christmas season, particularly those on Christmas Eve. And in this regard, today is probably as close as I'll get to preparing a Christmas Eve service. Our closing words are from Lucille Anderson, and they are related to Christmas Eve. And following those words, we will have the extinguishing of the chalice by Annalise, and finally, our circle song led by Kathy. These words from a little poem by Lucille Anderson. Sigh softly, lest you break the bauble that is Christmas. Within its tender, iridescent walls, unpierced by fury, prejudice, or scorn, bells peal, eyes shine, and children laugh, while song escorts gold-threaded hours into the star-sprayed night.